fake the money.
What is this? That is beautiful. Okay.
That much?
Wait, it's only 21 slides. Alright, so let's try the game. Alright. As I said, I'm going to try to explain first a little bit the strange title. And it has to do with fun and the fact that, in general, for inertial observers, free fields are rather boring entities. You have your asymptotic space, free-going matrix, nothing happens, so life is quite dull. But that's not actually true for non-inertial observers. So let me try to explain this a little bit more. This is maybe something that all of you know quite well. But the point is that inertial observers just measure time, let's say, in the same way, in the sense that they measure energy, they share the same notion of energy. And this leads to the same notion of vacuum state for all inertial observers. While observers that measure different energies or they have different concept of time will have, in general, different notions of vacuum states. And here I'm referring to well-known examples like inertial, like accelerator observers, which do not share the same vacuum state as inertial observers, and this is the basis of the famous Unruh effect. And in non-trivial backgrounds, we have, for example, free-falling versus fiducial observers in this vacuum background, and this is the basis of the Hawking effect. And also, observers in an expanding universe will experience some cosmological particle creation. This was discovered by Parker in the late 60s. So what I'm trying to say is that, yes, free fields are boring in our lab if we are boring inertial observers, but they become quite alive if we start doing something funny outside the lab. And a less known context in which this happens, in which free quantum fields exhibit some non-trivial features, is within the context of quantum field theories of non-commutative spaces. And this will lead to a notion of deformed Fock space, which is going to be almost the main subject of this talk. So let me start by recalling some very basic facts underlying the introduction of symmetries in a quantum setting. So imagine we have our quantum system described by a certain Hilbert space H, and we have the generators of a certain group of symmetries given by a Lie algebra. And the action of the generator of symmetry belonging to the algebra on a composite system, for example, the tensor product of these Hilbert spaces here, two identical Hilbert spaces, will be given by what we learned in elementary school, which is the Leibniz rule. First act on the first, second act on the second. And the action on observables, namely on self-adjoint operators on this guy here, will be given by this commutator action, this so-called adjoint action. And this, again, will have some sort of Leibniz property as well. These are quite basic facts. And as we're scientists and we are very curious, one natural question will be, is there any generalization to these very basic facts underlying the introduction of symmetries, underlying the implementation of symmetries in quantum mechanics or quantum theory? And the answer to this is yes, indeed. A well-known example of this is supersymmetry, where all the stuff you saw in the previous slides, becomes graded. A less popular example comes from two-dimensional quantum field theory. Indeed, there are certain integrable models in 2D, in two dimensions, which exhibit sets of non-local conserved charges. And these non-local conserved charges give a symmetry generator which acts via a so-called braided commutator. Instead of a grading here, we have some sort of generalized grading. And this braided commutator, it's telling me, this kind of exchange algebra here is telling me that now these QAs here do not generate a group once exponentiated, but what is called a quantum group. Namely, at the mathematical level, people say that we have a transition from a Lie algebra framework to a Hopf algebra framework. And Quite interestingly, the new algebraic structure contained in this, what we call op-algebra mathematical description, it has enough information which encodes actually the whole, all we need to know about the theory. So describing this whole op-algebra of QAs here is enough to actually completely solve the theory. So my question here would be, is there an example of this kind of generalization of Lie algebra symmetries into what we call quantum groups for space-time symmetries? And most important of all, has this anything to do with real world? Okay? And I'll try to answer to these questions.
I'm trying to understand, why isn't this a Lie algebra?
It's not a Lie algebra?
Yeah.
Because the action is not the standard action that you would have via commutator here. Normally, if these guys would generate a Lie algebra, you would have like a usual commutator. And instead of reduces to one, then you will have
so this
a standard
is not a commutator, it has a theta.
Yeah, system. Yeah, of these guys.
And what is theta?
Theta are just parameters.
Just numbers.
Yeah.
Two-dimensionally, mean 1 + 1?
Yeah.
What kind of field is involved?
I don't know. I don't remember exactly the details. This is wonderful review by Bernard and Leclerc about this, but yeah, I don't remember the precise details. That's why I put it there. I was like, okay. So, but all right. So let me start the actual talk. So the outline here is following. I will start with some rather pedantic review of free field quantization and symmetries. And then I will move on to the simplest example we have of a symmetry deformation, which is within the context of twisted quantum fields. And in this simplest example, I will show you how this symmetry deformation is actually connected with notion of non-commutative spaces. And then I'll move on to my particular example, which is kappa Poincaré algebra with related kappa quantum field quantization. And I'll give you a very neat example of what the new non-trivial structures will provide us in a multiparticle sector of these theories.
So is the third one separate from the second one? Or
yeah, because it's a different kind of symmetry deformation, you'll see later on. So it's, I'll give you like this as a gentle introduction to the symmetry deformation, deformed quantum fields, and then I'll move on to my favorite type of deformation. All right, so let's go back some years here in school and start looking at what is field quantization. So for classical fields, a state is just given by a point in phase space. Here my phase space, I wrote here gamma sigma, it's basically the space of initial data on a given Cauchy surface. This could be valid for any global hyperbolic space, but I'm just sticking to standard Minkowski space in this case. So you can just imagine this as a space like other surfaces. And observables would be just functions on this phase space over here. And let me stress that in the classical realm, if I'm talking about joint systems, I'm talking about direct sum of phase spaces of the individual systems. On the quantum side, we have that the state is a ray on a complex Hilbert space, observables are self-adjoint operators, and most importantly, joint systems this time are described by tensor products of the single Hilbert spaces. Quantization is just a recipe from going from left to right. And
by sum of two classical phase spaces?
Direct sum. Or let's say Cartesian product, is that better?
Okay,
so this thing in the framework of free quantum fields is this transition in the realm of free quantum fields is better seen in what people call the covariant phase space formalism. Instead of working with this object here, which, you know, needs a notion of time, a notion of foliation of your space, you just use the isomorphism between initial data and the solutions of the equations of motion, which for our scalar field is just a Pythagorean equation, and take as your phase space the space of solutions of the equations of motion. And so the first step to get here to Hilbert space, you complexify the space, and then you need to define an inner product for Hilbert space to be such. And it turns out that you can construct such Hilbert product, such inner product from
the symplectic product in the space of solutions, which is given by the Wronskian of the Cohen-Gordon equation, and introducing some appropriate notion of complex conjugation over there. Turns out that this guy here, as is, on the whole space of solutions, is not a positive definite. You need to restrict to the positive energy solution subspace. And this will give you the one particle of the space. And then you want to build your n particle spaces, and then you take tensor products, but these particles are supposed to be identical, so you have to symmetrize, and then you end up with a nice, good old Fock space for your scalar field, which is just boson Fock space. Okay? As I said, observables are just functions of phase space in a classical setting, and so with each observable we associate an operator on the one particle of the space. And here's the first interesting thing over here. Back in the 50s, when people were trying to give a mathematical construction to this canonical quantization procedure, Cook introduced the notion of second quantization of this one particle operator, namely the object that then will act on your full Fock space. And you see that this notion of second quantization entails a recipe for duplicating and triplicating and blah, blah, blah your one particle operator. Turns out that 30 years later, this notion of duplicating the operator
came back
in the field of mathematics, which deals with off algebras, and this duplication here is known as the coproduct of the operator. Coproduct is just telling me how, given an operator which acts on a certain module space, I can construct the representation on the tensor product of these modules. And I can write down this notion of second quantized one particle operator in terms of this coproduct and iteration of it. Now, space-time symmetries, that's what we're interested in. These are just special observables. Why are they special? Well, first of all, because they do close an algebra, and also because the Hilbert space that we constructed comes from the space of solutions of the Cohen-Gordon equation, and as such, it naturally carries a unitary reducible representation of the Poincaré algebra. And so we have a natural action of the generators of this algebra as one particle operators on the one particle Hilbert space. And we can actually, what you usually do when we do textbook quantum field theory, we take a commuting set of such operators, for example, the spatial translation generators, to label our one particle states and then our Fock space states. And the coproduct, what the coproduct says is just tells us how to extend the action of these guys here to multiparticle spaces, states. Okay, this is, was the two boring slides, I hope. So now the natural question you might have at this point is, what does this have to do with please, Rasmus?
All this was very special to free fields.
Yeah, okay. And I'm not going to stick just to free fields, indeed. As I said, the whole title was like fun from none. I'm trying to have fun with free fields. So what does all this have to do with symmetry deformation? Well, we just encountered the main actor of our play, the coproduct, in the previous slide. This coproduct is just telling us how relativistic symmetry generators act on n particle states, just via iterations of this coproduct over here. Okay, so my own take on the notion of deforming symmetry is simply the following. So to me, deforming a symmetry means introduce a modulation, what I call a modulation of the usual coproduct, or also of the usual Leibniz rule, weighted by a certain deformation scale, which I call generically Q here. So this is the modulation. And this modulation has to be such that the new action on tensor product states is non-symmetric. Okay, so this guy here acting on alpha tensor beta is different than the same thing acting on beta tensor alpha. So what I'm doing here is just via this modulation, I'm realizing the symmetries on the multiparticle or multi-state sector of my theory in a non-symmetric way. So a non-symmetric Leibniz rule. Okay, so this is my starting point.
Some operator.
Yeah, so we'll see later with two examples of F.
And for Q equals 0, then
Yeah, you just go this for q equal to zero. This F should be just the identity. Okay.
Well.
Yes.
You really mean that equation literally? I mean, even if we said g equals to one, it's not true. Hmm? You really mean it doesn't commute with exchange or something?
Yeah.
But it's just a minor thing. But I think the way you wrote it
might be sloppy.
Might be sloppy because. Of course, alpha tensor beta is not equal to beta tensor.
Yeah. I'm saying, okay, imagine these guys here are eigenstates of this guy over here, okay? And now I'm doing this, and I will get an eigenvalue which is different from the other eigenvalue. You will see an example of this. Normally, if you think about this as your field modes in terms of the field mode, then you and this as your translation generator, this will give you the total momentum of this guy. And you should, okay, so we'll see an example of this. Yeah, so this is kind of a little bit sloppy, but just to give you the idea.
Also, if you choose alpha equal beta, then you have the left hand side, it's the same as the right hand side, but it's not the same.
Okay, excuse me this thing, but you'll see the examples.
I'm always equal.
It was just supposed to be like an intuitive way of understanding what I mean by that.
But let me remark here. That from this perspective of like of my own take on the symmetry deformation, the idea of deforming space-time symmetry is just a purely quantum. Okay, in this case, I'm sticking to relativistic field.
Purely quantum relativistic phenomenon, in the sense that I'm just touching. I'm just basically not deforming the concept of special relativity or anything fancy. I'm just simply changing the way classical relativistic symmetries are implemented in the multiparticle sector of my boring free quantum field. That's it. That's nothing deeply philosophical about it. So, okay, let me try to be a little bit more concrete, okay? And just let me review in a few slides the usual Fock space construction. So you fix a plane wave basis over one particle per space, then you can describe a one particle state as in terms of this basis, these are the coefficients of the basis, and you have your n particle state as a vector superposition of this basis vectors here, which are given by the sums over symmetrized tensor products of the plane waves. And then you can introduce, given an element of the Fock space in terms of these coefficients, you can introduce creation and annihilation operators in a usual fashion. This guy contracts with each term and moves one term on the other side, on the left. And then you have creation operator, which just pushes everything to the right, adding one more state and symmetrizing it. And then these guys will satisfy the usual commutation relations.
Well, this whole construction, which is kind of easy and we all know how to do it in a standard case, becomes very involved when we start deforming in the sense I told you two slides before. And so let me start, as I promised, from this example of twisted quantum fields. So in this case, what I call the modulation map is given by this operator that mathematicians call the Drinfeld twist. You see that in this case, okay, so we have the translation generator. This is antisymmetric over here.
So what is theta?
Theta is the antisymmetric matrix.
An arbitrary act?
Yeah, you can put constants there. Right?
But,
yes.
The P alpha and tensor P beta is symmetric, right?
Mm-hmm. But these are operators, okay? So they're
and
active.
You want them to be the translation operator.
Mm-hmm. So, and you see that if you can do the little game I showed you before, yes.
Alpha running from 0 to 3. Right, did you see the alpha beta?
4. Hmm? 4. From 0 to 3, yeah. Sorry. So, you know that you can see that if you go back and do the little game of modulating your original Leibniz rule using this guy, of course, you will obtain a trivial Leibniz rule for momentum generators
again. So this deformed one would be still the trivial one. But now you will have a non-trivial Leibniz rule action for boosts and rotation generators.
But the most important thing to know to notice at this point is the following. So imagine, yes, Lee. Yeah, what I showed.
You want to see it again? It's here.
This F, would that be what is called a unitary twist? Would that be a triangular quantum group that you get?
Quasi triangular.
But is it not the special case of a triangular one?
No. Yes, no.
Because that would mean that up to a change of variables.
No. It is non-triangular. Quasi-triangular, sorry. Yeah, if you... No, okay, so that's the whole point. So if you have something here that will give you a new guy, let's say here, which is different than the original one but symmetric, then what you're saying is true. You could just do a redefinition and go back to the symmetric case. In this case, what I'm calling deformation is something that leads me into a non-symmetric deformed Leibniz rule.
So you really get the representation of the break group, not the permutation group?
No. I do get still a representation of the symmetric group.
But then it's triangular.
How?
Well, but that's the definition of it.
Could be a little bit more clear with that?
Well, it means that you can't distinguish over from under crossings, right?
But, okay, you're saying, wait, in this case, see that the product for the momenta has not changed. So when I'm building the Fock space with this guy here, okay, everything is fine. I just get some factors which depend on this guy here, okay? But then, well, you're looking at also at this sector here. Here, this is going to be a part of the whole story. Okay, so maybe if you restrict to this case, then you can say, okay, this is triangular, of course, because I'm not changing anything. But so when you're constructing the Fock space, you're looking at this side of the game, at least when you're constructing with, like, you know, modes, normal, like, eigenstates of B. But the important part here is the following.
Is that once you deal with states on a one-part equilibrium space, you take a tensor product of these states. What happens is, if I want to flip these two factors in the tensor product, now this operation of flipping is not any longer an intertwiner of my full deformed Poincaré algebra. Simply because the action of the Lorentz rotations here at this non-symmetric Leibniz rule. Get this? Imagine I take this tensor product here, okay? And I act with mu nu, with delta theta mu nu. I will get something which is different than if I apply this guy to the flipped version of it. Okay? And so my standard operation of flipping is not an intertwiner any longer, but there is a new notion of flipping these plane wave solutions, which is given by this notion of flipping, the so-called twisted flip operator, which indeed is an intertwiner of the action of for the action of this deformed Lorentz.
Your Fock space, you still
have by symmetrizing. Yeah, I haven't built the Fock space yet. I'm going to show it now.
The fact that the co-product has this funny behavior there on the ends, does it mean that angular momenta and generalized angular momenta are no longer additive?
Yeah, exactly. The composition is non-abelian. Okay, so now if I want to go back and do my funny game constructing the Fock space
using symmetrized tensor products, for what I just told you, I cannot use the usual unsymmetrized flip operator, but I do need to use what I call, what I showed you just above here, the twist flip. So in constructing n particle states, I have to be careful and I have to symmetrize my states using this object now. And to make the long story very short, when you introduce the creation and annihilation operators, these guys now will satisfy no longer my canonical commutation relations, but this kind of exchange algebra type of commutation relations, which contain always these factors over here. Okay, so this is the new ingredients that this theta deformation is bringing into the Fock space. What is the connection between this deformation, this notion of deformation, and what we call non-commutative spaces, non-commutative fields, and blah, blah, blah? Well, it turns out that those elements, if you take those plane waves as elements of this theta-deformed Hilbert space,
They can be seen as functions on what people call the Moyal plane, okay, which is this type of non-commutative space. And where is the non-commutative coming from? Well, it's precisely coming from the strange behavior of plane waves under exchange of the components of the tensor product. Indeed, in ordinary Minkowski space, my plane waves are just elements of a commutative algebra of functions on it, all right, on Minkowski space. If instead we want to try to introduce an algebra structure for our twisted plane waves, to introduce a multiplication, notion of multiplication of plane waves, these has to be compatible with the non-trivial tensor structure. It cannot be the usual point-like multiplication. And indeed, if this is the usual point-like multiplication, the new multiplication will be given by composing this with my Drinfeld twist, and this will give rise to what people call, I mean, maybe some of you have heard this before, a star product. Now, multiplying two plane waves via the star product is a non-commutative operation. Indeed, you can see that due to the antisymmetry of this guy over here, these products will be different. So these twisted plane waves now belong to a non-commutative algebra of functions. And here is the connection with, let's say, loosely speaking, non-commutative geometry. Yes, please.
So this is a two-particle state, what you're writing.
Not really, because I should symmetrize it. But, think about,
So then the terms. Just before the last, you have EP plus Q, so that's just one particle state. So I'm confused how you have a two particle state. And
well, because the multiplication is taking like tensor product, and yeah, I'm just thinking about multiplication here as an operation defined on tensor product of my function space, which brings me to just thinking about it as functions, okay?
So
just taking two copies of the space, multiplying, I get one.
So if one sets theta to zero, this is EP times EQ is EP plus Q. So that's what you get if you just take them as commutative functions and multiply them. That's E to the IP, that's E to the IP.
Okay,
this is a modification of that multiplication.
Sorry.
Does that make sense? So these are not particles.
No, I'm not. I mean, this is a mathematical statement,
okay,
but notional increase.
I
just wanted to make a connection with what you know people call like non-commutative spaces and stuff.
This is exactly the connection here. So, loosely speaking, this brings you to what is the basic concept of non-commutative geometry. In non-commutative geometry, what you do, you have a space. Yes.
Just to realize the first thing. So.
It's clever, though, before people start asking many questions, but this is not my stuff. I mean, I don't work on this. This is just introductory sort of material, but...
Okay,
it's good. No, yeah, please. Maybe I can say...
No,
sorry, though. By the way, this is the last slide on this theta stuff, so... But no, okay.
So the whole idea of non-commutative geometry is the following, like very roughly speaking. Okay, I'm like talking about I know nothing of non-commutative geometry, and I'm telling you that. But the basic idea is the following: instead of describing a space, yeah, the space itself, yeah, the geometric properties of the space itself, just describe it using the algebra function in it, and so the algebra functions becomes the central object. And now you can turn this algebra function into a non-commutative one. But in this case, you lose the notion of ordinary differential manifold underlying your space of functions, which is only recovered if you take the commutative limit of your algebra function. Okay? This is just to give you the really very intuitive notion of what people do in non-commutative geometry side. So, let me move now to my own model. I mean, model I've been working on for the last two or three, 4 years, maybe. And why are we interested in this model? Well, my main interest in this model is that it comes from essentially three-dimensional gravity, the behavior of particles coupled to three-dimensional gravity. So, and I'm going to try to show this like in a very, very sketchy way on this slide. So excuse me for any like technical looseness I'm going to have here. But
because 3D refers to three space dimensions, okay?
2 plus 1, okay. Consider a phase space of relativistic point particle in three-dimensional 2 plus 1 in Kosky space, okay? And it turns out that you can describe this phase space in terms of actually the generator of the Poincaré algebra. This is just, if you think back to what I said at the beginning, like phase space as a space of solutions of the equations of motion. Now think of what are the solutions of the equations of motion for a relativistic free particle. It's just straight lines. And this can be parameterized by these parameters over here. These guys over here, sorry. And these Poisson brackets will give you the Poisson structure of the phase space.
Why did you reduce the dimension? What's the benefit?
Because then I want to couple it to gravity. And the whole game is like, okay.
So all the nice details about this and this and what I'll say later are given in this nice review by Bernd Schroers. Okay. So I still have no gravity over here. Okay. So this is a phase space. Upon quantization, that funny second quantized thing that I show you in the previous slides is just telling me that now these guys here become observables, which belong to what some mathematically oriented people call the universal enveloping algebra of the Poincaré algebra, which is a semi-direct product of these two guys over here. This is not very important. Just keep in mind here that we are dealing on the translation sector with functions on R3, on R21. Okay, this is both, yes.
This is quantization of
this quantum field theory in three dimensions. Quantum field theory in three dimensions.
It's quantum field theory or quantum particle dynamics?
It's the same. If I do quantize a relativistic particle, I will get reducible representations of the Poincaré algebra. And so, in the spirit, I told you before.
But you just have one particle state so far.
Yeah, this is refers to one particle state, but actually, this is referring to the fact. Sorry, I said I was going to be sketchy on this slide, but this refers to the fact that I actually have a Fock space. And this UP3 here means that I'm taking polynomials of the generators of the, for example, three-dimensional Lorentz group. And these polynomials are in the sense of these second quantized observables that I wrote you before. Okay, that's why I put this U here. If it would have been only P3, that would be like, you know, the one particle quantization of the guy. So as I said again, pardon my sketchiness on this slide. What you have to keep in mind here, and that is that this is your translation sector, and you have like your nice old good R3 over here. So why did I restrict to three dimension? Because okay, 2+1 gravity in three dimension, 2+1 dimensions is a topological theory, and I can couple point particles as defects. And it turns out, please for details refer again here, that if I do the same game and quantize this Poisson brackets over here, now instead of getting this, I will get what mathematicians call the Lorentz double of SU11. Notice here that on the Lorentz side, we have the same object, but now momenta become coordinate function on SU11, this group. And that's where the fun kicks in, is that now, being now a coordinate function in a group, and not only any longer on my familiar R3, now they will exhibit a deformed coproduct. And here you see, you get your gravitational constant in there to the Planck mass appearing. These are higher order terms in this guy. And for more details about other contexts in which you get more or less the same, are over there. So, okay, finally, Capo-Poincaré. Why do I like Capo-Poincaré? It's like very obscure mathematical construction that came out of Poland in the early 90s. And why do we like it? It's just because It's just because it shares a very crucial, important feature with this Lorentz double that I showed you emerging in the context of three-dimensional gravity coupled to point particles. namely a modification of the Leibniz rule for spatial translation generators, which in the particular realization of Capo-Poincaré, which I will be discussing in the next slides, will take this form. Okay? It's highly non-symmetric. You see here that you get a term, instead of the identity here, you get a term which depends on kappa now is my deformation parameter. Now think of the Q I introduced before as 1 over kappa, okay? So that when kappa goes to infinity, this guy here just reduces to 1 and I get my ordinary Leibniz rule. As I showed with Dario Benedetti, this kind of deformed coproduct can be obtained introducing a modulation map, which is the following, and this is not a Dreamfield twist, it doesn't have any deep mathematical meaning, it's just a map that's giving me this ugly coproduct starting from my ordinary nice Leibniz rule.
Yeah.
Yes, sorry, yeah. Okay, sorry, I didn't mention this. So, Capo-Poincaré, we like Capo-Poincaré because it's the only four-dimensional example of deformed algebra of relativistic symmetries which exhibits this feature, namely a modification of the Leibniz rule for momenta. Okay? This is why we like it, because as far as today, this is the only known example of deformed symmetries in four dimensions, which are
just spatial.
In this particular, okay, for Capo-Poincaré, only spatial translation generators are modified.
Is it only known, or it was proven that there are no other deformations?
Really? Some question.
No.
Actually, I thought it was a statement. I was like, wow. So all of a sudden, all this work becomes like, you know, the work. On
the, so the answer is
there is some ongoing work.
We know the answer.
You know, yeah. So there is some ongoing work. As far as I'm aware, there is some ongoing work by Etera Divin and Daniele Origi on trying to find the deformed algebra of symmetries underlying what is known as the Snyder non-commutative space. Snyder non-commutative space is different than... Okay, I'll get to Kapraminkowski. Snyder is just a different type of non-commutative space, and they're trying to find out the four-dimensional deformation of Poincaré algebra which might underlie that kind of non-commutativity. But it's still ongoing work. They don't have a final answer to that yet. So, in this case, this momenta can be seen as momentum space can be seen as a group submanifold of the Sitter space. You restrict here, and basically this special realization of the Poincaré algebra, of the Capo-Poincaré algebra, can be seen just as a specific choice of coordinates on this submanifold. Okay.
There's something that confused me. This tensor product. What does it mean?
This means that if I take a tensor product, if I take a two-particle state, this guy is acting on the first, this guy is acting on the second.
Okay, so these are indeed tensor products and two particles. I see.
In general, you would say any representation of the Poincaré algebra. Take tensor product representations, this guy is telling you how these generators will act on this tensor product representation.
So this is defined only on the two particles?
Then? Yeah, then you can iterate, as I showed you in the second slide, how you can iterate it.
Kiro, what's the physics of the left tensor factor as opposed, what distinguishes it from the right tensor factor?
We'll see. I'm actually, the neat example of all this theoretical mumbling that I'm doing would be on the last two slides is actually quite nice.
Just with the physics of the line, sure you would have left and right, but
Let's see.
It's going
to be quite nice, actually. Okay, so let me mention another feature of this particular realization of Capo-Poincaré. The usual standard mass Casimir invariant, which is normally P0 squared minus vector P squared, now is deformed. And this leads to a deformed mass shell condition, which has, as I said, over the years, a lot to do with the all these efforts in trying to look for phenomenological effects of this type of deformations, but I have to add a little warning here, because here we're just still working at a purely algebraic level. If you do really want to confront these kind of things with real life, you should just roll up your sleeves, build your field theory, calculate the stress energy tensor, calculate the charges, and then that's going to be what is actually your real life. But this is at this level is just a Casimir operator of this deformed algebra. Yes. Another feature is that now boosts act in a deformed way on momenta, okay? It's on spatial momenta. They act in a standard way on energies. And again, also boosts have a deformed Leibniz rule, while note that time translation generators have usual Leibniz rule, and the rotation sector is untouched as well, okay? The nice feature of this whole thing is that if you let this deformation parameter go into infinity, you recover the ordinary Poincaré algebra and so on and so forth. What is the connection with non-commutative space in this case? Okay. Back in 1994, just a couple of years after this deformed algebra was introduced, Majid and Rex showed that this deformed algebra has this structure, okay, that which they dubbed Bikers product structure. This ugly sign here is just a generalization of the direct product. And these are functions on a certain group. But to translate this in layman language, it's just that momenta are coordinate functions on this group, which is obtained basically from exponentiating this Lie algebra of coordinates. Okay, and this Lie algebra of coordinates is what we call Kappa Minkowski space. This is nice because now this gives me a more intuitive characterization of the coproduct for translation generators. Indeed, take plane waves on this non-commutative space. Okay, these plane waves will just be group elements. These are exponents of a Lie algebra. So these plane waves will be non-commutative objects, and we'll have this non-commutative algebra structure, which is given by what again we call a star product. And this star product now has to be compatible with this. What I mean by this? I mean that if I take the tensor product of two plane waves and I measure the momentum, okay, this is what this means, and then I multiply the two, this should be equal to taking the product and measuring the full momentum of the plane wave I get. Okay, so these two actions should commute. Measuring momentum and multiplying.
So what's the star?
It's a star product. So I mean by this that this, yeah, because this guy applied
on this tensor product will give me again the tensor product, and then I multiply the tensor product. In this case, instead, I have multiplied already the tensor product and getting the. So if you actually evaluate this using the expression for the coproduct I gave you in the previous slide, you will see the following: that the total momentum of a product of plane waves will be given by p1. So momentum of the first plane wave, plus dot p2. Why did I say plus dot? Because due to the fact that now this guy is ugly and non-symmetric, this plus dot means at the level of four vectors that the sum on energies is the same, but the linear modes here will have this strange composition. So this composition of momenta is non-abelian. Okay? This looks very ugly indeed.
Sorry.
But
the star product, the usual model,
no, because it's a different
one, which corresponds to this notation.
Yeah. But it's very hard to find actually a specific expression for it. Indeed. Okay, so let me do quantum field theory now.
You can think now of the Hilbert space, of the one particle Hilbert space of a scalar field, just as functions on this deformed mass shell here. Okay, this is basically the Fourier version of your space of solutions. And you can equip this with inner product, which is given by, you take your standard symplectic form in space-time, Fourier transforming in momentum space, and then do the twisting. You will get a deformed symplectic structure. From that, you can define the deformed inner product. You will find that this inner product here becomes no longer positive definite for transplanckian modes, I mean this. And so in order to define your one particle Hilbert space, you need to restrict to these functions of the positive mass shell truncated at kappa. And this is my Hilbert space, my one particle Hilbert space. But now actually here's the real fun. Please.
Does that truncation still give you a representation of the deformed Poincaré algebra?
Yes, indeed, because I have deformed boosts, and these boosts saturate. So if I take a mode which is sub-Planckian, and I try to boost it with my deformed boost, and I let the boost parameter go to infinity, I will hit.
So it's something like a consistent ultraviolet regularization.
If you want to look at that, yeah. But the parameter can be any scale you want. This is a deformation parameter. Just you can lower it and put it higher and lower as you wish. It doesn't necessarily have to be like Planck scale or UV scale. It could even be like IR scale. But then I don't know if you get any trouble.
Is it a similar complication which happens for quantum groups? I mean, when you don't have representations of which are fired?
Probably. I don't know. What do you mean? Like when you do irreducible representations of quantum groups, you have some similar truncation?
Yeah, but we consider, for example, I think Chan-Simons theory, mm-hmm. we have quantum groups representation theory, and then we don't have representations higher than the run potential.
So. Yeah, it might be actually analogous. I never thought about it this way, actually.
One particle set no longer corresponds, or they do correspond to solutions of the Klein-Gordon version.
Correspond to functions on the deformed mass shell.
But that which looks like it's not solutions of the Klein-Gordon.
What is the Klein-Gordon equation on this non-commutative space?
I mean, it's the ordinary. Okay,
it's not position.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have to give up the space-time description because now I don't have a notion of differential manifold anymore, so it doesn't make sense to do any kind of evolution of initial data or anything. So I just stick to what is the group theoretic version of it, which is functions on the mass shell. So,
maybe I just heard something wrong, but I thought you told us that you still have the ordinary Poincaré group in the one particle set. Was that just wrong?
No.
Okay.
It's deformed also the one particle sector. But, yeah. Oh. Okay, so let me now tell you the nice story of the day, okay?
So, now I want to do again Fock space. So, as I showed you before, in order to obtain this full bosonic Fock space, I need to do some kind of symmetrization of my one-particle space, okay? And, you know, naively, I could go on and try to do the same for this kappa-deform case. But, if you go take my ordinary symmetrized state like this, two-particle symmetrized state, and you do act with the deformed coproduct, you will see that this guy is no longer an eigenstate of the translation generator. Okay? What you have to do now, well, so what you want to do, you want to look for a symmetrized state, which is indeed instead an eigenstate of translation generators. And it turns out that in order to do so, again, as in the case of the twisted Poincaré symmetries, you need to introduce a modulated flip, not the ordinary flip any longer. And this modulated flip can be obtained with the nice map that we found with Dario Benedetti in our wonderful paper. So this modulated flip is given by the following. Okay? Let me spend like 10 seconds on this. You see, here what I'm doing is I'm flipping the cats, but each cat gets a factor in front of the momentum label, and this factor depends on 1 minus the modulus of the other guy's momentum over the deformation scale. I know. So, what's happening now? Due to the non-Leibniz nature of my coproduct, I go on, I start from this two-particle state, I symmetrize using this guy, and I will get the state that I call K1, K2, which is the following. If I start from this other guy, however, and I symmetrize, I will get a different part here. So I will get a second two-particle state, which I call K2, K1. These two states are truly different. They are, because they have different momentum eigenvalues. This guy will have a momentum eigenvalue which is kappa k1 plus dot k2. And this guy will have a momentum eigenvalue which is k2 plus dot k1. However, these two states will have the same total energy due to the fact that the Leibniz rule for energy is not changed. If you try to do this for n particle states, of course, you will have, if you start from n different modes, you will get n factorial different n particle states. Okay? But now, what's happening here? So this non-trivial algebraic structure, which we introduced at the level of deformation of algebra, is providing my Fock space, what once was the boring ordinary Fock space, with a fine structure. Let's see how. As I said, these two states have different momentum eigenvalues. Okay? In principle, I can measure these two different momentum eigenvalues. However, the splitting between these two momentum eigenvalues will be in generally suppressed by your whatever scale you're putting in there. Like if you think about the Planck energy, it's a very tiny momentum separation between the two states. So, in principle, I can resolve this difference between the states, but I should have like a nice Planckian magnifying glass to see that. Okay? So, I write my two-mode Hilbert space as the following. Yeah.
Do you think all these particles indistinguishable? Because it seems to me that they have different energies than distinguishing. If you flip them, you get different energies. Oh, you say you get the same energy, but you get different momentum.
Yeah.
So, but that still means there are.
But the whole idea why I was doing the symmetry addition is exactly because I want these guys to be indistinguishable.
Yeah.
But in doing this, in some way I lose something. You see, I have now a well-defined notion of total momentum for the system of two particles.
Yeah.
But I lose in some way a notion of individual energy for the particles. So they become even more indistinguishable. So, as I said, in principle, I can measure the splitting in momentum of the two states, and the splitting is tiny, so I can actually say, look, my two states over here,
k1, k2, k2, k1, that I built starting from, you know, two one-particle states. Now I say these guys belong to a two-particle Hilbert space, which I call H2 kappa, which is basically just the ordinary symmetrized Hilbert space, plus some spin degrees of freedom over here, which are just telling me if my state is 1-2 or 2-1. Okay? So given the fact that these states are degenerating energy, I can say, okay, label them as the energy they carry times spin up or spin down degree of freedom. Okay? And here is the total energy, epsilon. And now what happens? The Planckian mode entanglement becomes possible, of course, for you guys that are familiar with these things. I was not before actually hitting this problem, but thanks to Alyosha, I actually started looking at these things. Indeed, consider, for example, a state which is a superposition of two classical, quote, classical, I mean, they just add in the standard way. So, like, energy epsilon A and energy epsilon B. And so the superposition I'm going to take is the following. Epsilon A with spin up and epsilon B with spin down. This is entangled with respect to this Planckian degrees of freedom. And so what? Well, now imagine I'm looking at my system, and I describe it through a density matrix, and I'm evolving my system. I start from, I don't know, from a given density matrix, and I'm evolving it
according to some time evolution.
And imagine that at the beginning of my time evolution, I start with a pure state, which is factorized with respect to this bipartition here, the bipartition
that I
wrote in the previous slide also. So if this unitary evolution operator acts as an entangled gate, then this final state will be entangled. And by entangled, I mean entangled with this Planckian degrees of freedom, okay? So a macroscopic observer, so an observer that doesn't have a Planckian magnifying glass, will not be able to resolve the Planckian degrees of freedom. And will just say that at the beginning, the state will be a pure state, because this macroscopic observer will trace on the Planckian degrees of freedom, but in this case, will just still see a pure state. While after a certain evolution, she will see a mixed state, because she will again trace over the Planckian degrees of freedom. But in this case, the state is entangled. So she will effectively experience
decoherence, non-unitary evolution. Okay? So, surprisingly, symmetry we started from something which is completely disconnected with the scenarios of decoherence in quantum gravity, and we ended up having a simple model which actually exhibits decoherence due to the presence of some Planckian degrees of freedom. And this, I think, is quite neat. Also because, I don't know, it could be a window to new phenomenological effects for people that are interested in this kind of quantum gravity phenomenology and so on and so forth. I haven't looked at that yet, but it seems promise.
Where this non-unitarity came about. So basically, this state I started from is pure, okay? Yeah. So it's factorized in this. Then this guy here, this evolution operator, is giving me an entangled state between these degrees of freedom. Okay? So the macroscopic observer, which only observes these degrees of freedom, at the beginning will trace over this, and will see still a pure state because it's a factorized state. At the end, when the state is entangled, she will still trace over these degrees of freedom, but now, because the state is entangled, you get the mixed state.
What is Cn?
Cn is this Planckian spin degrees of freedom. Imagine...
So it's a C2 in the
ratio
of the two
parts. Yeah, C2 here,
okay?
All right. And the up and down thing. So basically, let me give the last slide. All right, jump to the conclusion. So I tried to show you how relativistic symmetries can be realized on a quantum field theory of the space in ways which involve some non-trivial multiparticle structure. And I couldn't refrain from stealing this quote from Reed and Simon's book. There's a lot of room in hyperspace, even more than we thought, actually, after we deformed. Motivation to look at such deformations come from quantum gravity and non-commutative geometry scenarios in general, like loosely speaking. And when the deformation involves the behavior of field modes, so the translation generators, nice, interesting entanglement phenomena can take place. And it would be rather interesting to see what role these kind of deformations can have for all these trans-Planckian issues we have in semi-classical gravity. I'm thinking about black hole evaporation or inflation, so on and so forth. So with this, I'm done. Thank you very much.
On the previous slide, you said that you take... density matrix and we evolve it to a unitary operator, the first line there.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you suppose the evolution is unitary? Because you've deformed the symmetry. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have a good notion of a self-adjoint Hamiltonian. I don't know exactly what it happens. Why do you say that the evolution should be unitary?
I'm assuming there is some kind of because notion of time evolution.
One could say that maybe the evolution is not unitary, and when you trace over the Planckian degrees of freedom, you'll produce something which looks unitary from the point of view of the, you know, you can't exclude the conspiration.
Yeah, but I think the odds for that are quite low. I mean, I'm pretty sure, actually that's what I'm trying to work on right now, to define like some sort of time, notion of time evolution to this. So,
I don't understand where the symmetry came in, because in this argument of this next to last page, the very end, the entanglement business.
Mm. Yeah, that's this one.
Mm. No, further. Yeah, right here. This argument, this page, you could have put that up as the first page of the talk, right? Because it's always true whenever you have a unitary time evolution that mixes sub-Planckian with trans-Planckian degrees.
Yeah. Okay.
So why is it that symmetry forces that? Or
because these new Planckian degrees of freedom are coming from symmetry deformation. So I now have a Fock space that's giving me this additional fine structure, which comes from... the fact that the coproduct is deformed. So the new degrees of freedom are strictly related to the fact that now the coproduct is non-symmetric. It could have been deformed, but symmetric, you wouldn't have had this.
But doesn't that come back to Naya's question? Are they really indistinguishable? Isn't that fine structure at the expense of indistinguishability?
No, I don't see how...
Because your Hilbert space becomes smaller. And you say it becomes bigger again. Isn't that at the expense of indistinguishability?
Well, if you could find a way to distinguish these two guys, then I would be happy.
But their momenta are different.
No, but then you're looking at two particle states here, okay?
Yeah.
You're not looking at one particle state.
Sure,
okay?
Yeah.
If you look at the one particle state, you collapse, you don't have your deformed coproduct anymore. So you would have either you know the total momentum of these guys, or you know the individual momentum.
But can it be that only one of these states lives in the Hilbert space? Because look what we have. We always have like symmetric states and anti-symmetric states.
Mm-hmm.
In the usual for quantization, we just drop out one of them, depending on which
degrees
of Hilbert we have. Yeah? Now you also have essentially just linear combinations of these. Yeah? Just different linear combinations dictated by the symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
By the parameter couple. So, in some sense, one could say that one of them is symmetric, another one is anti-symmetric, so we should take maybe only one of them.
Well, I think it's quite painful to do that, because then you really give up symmetry. You just, you know, you say, okay, well, all my two-particle states will be like this, and all my three-particle states will be like that, and so on, but why? So, you're really cutting the face of your Fock space in a very, I don't know. I mean, this is my own take, okay? So, like, the whole motivation of this work was like trying to understand what is behind this deformed notion of Leibniz action, okay? That's it. So, and this is what I came up with, but I think, yeah, there's plenty of, yeah. Okay, so.
So the simple question, and a question moving forward. The simple question is, in two dimensions is a notion of braiding.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two different ways. There is an extra degree of freedom in how you symmetrize or anti-symmetrize in two dimensions, right over and under.
Yeah.
And so is this the three dimensional, is this the answer to the question of what could braiding mean in three dimensions?
No. This is still that representational symmetric group.
Right.
Should, yeah.
Right. But because there you pick up a feature which is like braiding, in that rather there are sort of two ways to symmetrize.
Mm-hmm.
Only it's not a simple pictorial. It's not braiding, but
the closest to pictorial thing that I found at the time when I was working on this is this. It's loops instead of having point particles. Like in 3D, you can have loops that have non-trivial braiding.
Right.
But this is it's called the loops braid group.
Right.
And apparently, it doesn't have anything to do.
Okay.
But yeah, because I was looking for something pictorial to understand this,
okay.
But. Apparently it's just trivial. You just had like this, that's why I call it rainbow statistics, you know, which sounds like, because you get this dependence of the exchange of the flipping, dependence of the flipping on the field modes.
No, but all I'm trying to say is it's not surprising that there's a new spin which is shared between two particles. I'm trying to symmetrize them because there are in two dimensions. The new spin would be whether you went over or under.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's that's what I'm trying to say. It's not surprising.
Yeah.
So the second question looking forward is, so once you have all this strained out, which is necessary to get strained out first, that is what the Fock space is like in the deformed case, how hard is it to go ahead and study interactions? At least define what the interactions that are interacting feel free with you.
So as far as I know, I mean, at least in the context of Kappa-Poincaré, introduction interactions the was done by me. No, back in 2001, we tried to do like path integral, but it was like led to some like very severe problems. Namely, you have problems in defining the action because you have ordering issues in defining the action. So, yeah, one could try different ways. You know, you can try like to work the purest matrix level, for example. That could be an idea.
I just wanted momentum space formulas to compute Feynman diagrams in momentum space.
Yeah. So one idea would be again to go look at like pure S matrix tools without having to define the path integral and so on. Like you just look at analyticity properties of, you know, once you have a notion of vacuum, which we do have now, you can start building like, you know, your two-point functions and so on and so forth, and but trying maybe to look at.
You said you don't have an explicit formula for the quadratic part of your action.
No, I mean you do,
so
but
you
do by proper
two-point functions, because the two-point functions for the Gaussian theory are given by the inverse of the quadratic part of your action.
I'm talking about the free theory now.
The
so
free
but
theory,
you write down that.
So the two-point function of the free theory is the propagator, which is the inverse of the quadratic function. You don't have any explicit formula for that.
No. What are you talking about? So the kinetic term, we do have it.
Ah, you have? So you have a kinetic equation.
Yeah. It's the Casimir. The momentum space is given by the Casimir. The deformed Casimir.
If you like, can we go to page 15, please?
It's good memory, yeah.
Right, yeah. I'm concerned that maybe you're describing physics in faraway galaxies as being different from here. Look at the communication between the XM and the T. If you shift X by a constant vector, you're not preserving your commutation relations, so you're not preserving your physics.
I think we're discussing this with Lydia. It's a very nice, neat extent, like.
Yeah. So my point of view of that is that because this doesn't exponentiate to a group. Okay. Indeed, there is a kind of horizon. Mm-hmm. That is, if you start to synchronize clocks, and you want to synchronize clocks at a certain frequency, so you have to use photons at least with a frequency as high as the clocks you want to synchronize. Mm-hmm. And there is then this is another talk, but if you then start with the clock and you're going to synchronize other clocks to it, and you're also going to try to use Einstein's prescription to synchronize moving clocks, but if you have to use a photon of a frequency larger than the frequency of the clocks you're trying to synchronize, there's a horizon beyond which the synchronization becomes ambiguous. So just like if this curvature, inertial frames have a limited scope, only go so far out.
I see. So basically you're saying that could only be the physics locally, and mm-hmm. then you have to glue it together, basically, to form.
You have to glue it together, and because it's not a group, translating and boosting don't have a nice group structure so that you can translate, boost, and translate back, and just call it a boost here. Mm-hmm. But it is a kind of local structure. Mm.
The Lambert-Poincaré, maybe I should know that, but I don't. Is that obtained by Edwin Feldquist from
no.
the regular?
No, it's mathematically speaking, is obtained by deforming anti-de Sitter algebra and doing an Enon-Wigner contraction down to the Poincaré algebra, which preserves some scales. So basically, like the cosmological constant and the deformation parameter of anti-de Sitter, once contracted, give you the kappa of Poincaré. So for this reason...
But when you say it's a deformation of that, you don't say it is a Drinfield twist of that.
No.
It's not a Drinfield twist of anything else that we know of.
No. No. It's like deforming, but not through twist, and then contracting. So deforming and desitter, then contracting. So it's not...
Is it possible to think about this deformation as attaching a source of torsion in momentum space to each fermion?
Well, I don't know about fermions. I've been, yeah.
I mean, to these. Oh, sorry. These fields, right? Because you're in. Because you exchange in K space.
Uh-huh.
And what happens is your particles get shifted. Your momentum gets shifted, right? So it's like you go around one loop, and then it gets translated momentum, right?
B. Never thought about that. So you're saying that when you shift, then you have a torsion in momentum.
In momentum space. That's
it's
right.
Quite interesting way to look at it. Probably, yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you.